The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on its brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely, until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. So as I was thinking about Vajrasattva this morning, this kind of poem, I was reminded of this poem. It's just the first half of St. Francis and the Sow by Galway Kinnell. And I'll read it for you again later. I'll read the full poem. But I just love this sense, and for me it connects very much with Vajrasattva, this sense of kind of reteaching ourselves our loveliness. Or reteaching ourselves, what Vajrasattva reminds us of is our pure nature, our essential nature. And that's what Vajrasattva represents in essence. But it's much more alive in one of the myths associated with Vajrasattva, which is a myth of the return journey, which I relate to quite strongly. You may know this myth, but I'm going to tell you. I feel like telling a story. So I'm going to tell you the myth of the return journey. So it's the story of a father and a son living in India. But because it is a myth, in fact, we're going to kind of suspend reality. So outside time and space, we're in a myth where different things occur. So it's not literal at all. So the story is trying to tell us something different. So we've got a father and a son. And one day when the son's grown up, he leaves home. He decides to go in search of something. And of course the father's quite upset. He would like his son to stay, for his son to be there as they grow together, and he'd like to see his son grow, get married, do whatever he'd like his son to do. So the father's sad that the son goes off, and the father doesn't see the son again for many, many, many years. And the son wanders from town to town, taking odd jobs here and there, but nothing really ever happens. He's never really sure what he wants. So he just kind of keeps searching, never quite satisfied. And at times it's kind of then kind of in rags, kind of wandering around like a beggar, basically quite lost. And after many, many years, one day the king, or the father, who's become like a king, his riches have grown. He's very, very wealthy, respected. And he's sitting at the front of his mansion with all his attendants and all his servants. And the son kind of walks into town, and immediately the father recognizes his son. He recognizes him as his son. And he's just so happy. He's so happy to see his son. Although the son looks like a beggar, he's wearing rags, he's dirty. He asks his attendants to go and greet his son and ask him to come and see the father. But the son has become so scared that when the attendants come to see him, he just thinks he must be in trouble, so he runs. Thinks they're going to grab him and take him and put him in prison. So the son runs, and the attendants try to run after him, but they don't catch him. And they come back to the father and tell him this. And the father realizes that the son did not recognize the father because his circumstances are so changed. So he asks his attendants to go and ask the son to come and do some jobs at the palace. The jobs he starts to do are shifting dirt from a pile to another place. Yeah, just very simple jobs. That the son feels, okay, great, I can take that job, that's fine, I can cope with that, I'll do that. So he keeps kind of finding more and more jobs, father keeps finding more and more jobs for the son to do. And the jobs kind of rise in kind of status and complexity over time until the son starts coming in and out of the mansion and he starts to feel quite comfortable with that. Still, the son does not realise this is his father. But the father doesn't lose sight of the fact that this is his son. So the son keeps getting more and more used to the riches, the luxury, the kind of quality of life that the father lives in, until eventually he becomes the father's attendant. And he's then quite used to going down into the vaults where they keep all the riches and distributing the riches to, you know, kind of the people that they might be trading with. So he comes quite, kind of feels comfortable with handling all that richness. And he still doesn't realise that this is his father, and he does not realise that this is his inheritance. Until the father realises that he's dying, and he then reveals to his son that he is his father, and he's realised that the time is right, and the son can actually now hear it, and the son can take the fact that all this wealth is his. Mm-hmm. This is his inheritance, and he doesn't feel kind of separate from it anymore. He can kind of be with it. He's comfortable with it. And of course, and sadly, the king dies, and the son becomes the wealthy man with all the riches, taking care of all the people in the land. So this is the myth of the return journey, the myth of searching for something. We don't quite know what. We don't quite know what. The son kind of represents, I suppose, the lower, what Bante calls the lower part of ourselves. It's a great talk by Bante on the myth of the return journey on Free Buddhist Audio. And this lower part of ourselves searching for something, not quite satisfied, not quite knowing what it is. Do we recognise this? Mm-hmm. Yes. Kind of wanting to find something that satisfies us, but not really knowing what that is. And in the process, becoming perhaps quite poor, in a sense. Whereas meanwhile, all these riches are waiting for us. So the father represents kind of our higher self, our kind of, and the riches, spiritual qualities, that when we're in the position of the son, we feel quite estranged from. So in a way, when in the figure of Vajrasattva, Vajrasattva, as I said, is reminding us of the riches of the spiritual life, the riches of the enlightened mind, the riches of the awakened consciousness that are not as far away as we think. We've become, you know, feeling that we're quite estranged from them. And so in the figure of Vajrasattva, we start to perhaps start to see those riches even more, perhaps start to come a bit closer to and come home to our spiritual inheritance. So I love this myth because I feel it so much describes my own sense of searching, for what, when I was when I began kind of searching, my sense of a search for, I've got to find out the truth. What is the truth? What is real? You know, what can I actually place my faith in? What can I trust? And I suppose it can feel like a kind of a homecoming. I don't know if it felt like that to you when you first heard the Dharma, or the Dharma really, there's that sense of like kind of hitting home. You know, I've really felt like in the Dharma, I felt like I'd really come home. Mm. But it's not so easy to feel comfortable in that home. I think for all of us in our practice, it takes quite a while. you know, a little bit of meditation, oh, that's quite good, or maybe some sorrow could work for me now, feeling a bit happier. Maybe that could be fine. Oh, no, damn it. There's that lost, craving, searching sense again. You know, so we keep kind of like the sun, you know, kind of just getting used to, you know, kind of what is our good, our goodness, what the Dharma, what spiritual life can offer us. So for me, really this poem about reteaching ourselves, our loveliness, is very much connected to Vajrasattva. So part of the reason that we kind of feel this separation from, kind of the qualities of the enlightened mind is that we experience ourselves a bit like the sun, kind of limited, but also perhaps we have this sense of like we don't really want to change, not quite up for change. So that takes some time for us to kind of, you know, there's some desire for change, but we have to kind of keep going with it. So we have a limited sense of kind of what's possible. And Vajrasattva keeps reminding us that that can keep opening up and opening up. I really wanted to put him at the top of the shrine here because my first kind of encounter with Vajrasattva was at the top of our refuge tree. So if you've done the going for refuge and prostration practice, or if you've seen the refuge tree, Vajrasattva's right at the very tippy top. Whenever I was doing the visualization and building the tree right up to the top, there was, you know, the Vajrasattva just seemed to be kind of the pinnacle. But at the end of the practice, when it dissolves, I had a sense of Vajrasattva really coming down kind of to me. So there felt like this exchange between kind of like lifting up into the transcendental, but then the blessings of the transcendental kind of coming back down through Vajrasattva. So he's often called the Adi Buddha. Adi meaning before, or he's kind of beyond time and space. Before time and space, beyond time and space. He's outside time and space, which is where we've been in our mythical realm as well, in our mythical story. So he points to that kind of aspect of reality that is beyond time and space. So that's why it is hard for us to kind of conceive of it, because we're very much in time and space, and we're trying to open up to kind of more timeless dimension, more timeless space and boundless space. He's also often called the Prince of Purity because of this kind of being outside time and space. He's not tainted in any way by, a deluded, greedy, grasping mind. So he represents that as well. So he's a prince, royalty. And if you look at the picture there, you can kind of really get a sense of a young prince with his jewels and his robes. He's also very much associated with, it's often called the being of the bond. So samaya is a bond or a pledge, a vow. So if you kind of make a pledge to Vajrasattva, he will definitely honour it. I may not be able to honour it, but he will definitely honour it. So this samaya, this vow, this spiritual pledge that we may make to want to be like Vajrasattva or any Buddha or Bodhisattva. So Vajra, as we kind of know, is diamond, and we know the Vajra. Come on to that in a little bit. And Sattva is being. So he's the diamond being as well. So a diamond being. He's white in colour, although I love this image because it's just a hint of blue He's often kind of described as dazzling white in colour, like sunlight reflected on snow. And deep snow has that kind of bluey kind of tinge, and the light coming off it can have that as well. So I do quite like this image for that quite like a little bit of a bluey reflective whiteness, a kind of like a white blue. Just going back to this sense of the Prince of Purity, because purity is something that's associated with Vajrasattva. And I know that that purity is a word that we probably have a lot of connotations with, that might go back to kind of previous religious backgrounds, or, you know, being told that we need to be pure in a particular kind of way. So any of those kind of thoughts that you hold, that's not the purity of Vajrasattva. Again, it's this purity of kind of the awakened mind, which is not about being good. It's not about being bad and having to kind of somehow wash that away or deal with, you know, kind of a sense of us being sinners. That's probably the only way I can really talk about it, you know. It's definitely more of Vasantra talks about it as being kind of like, almost like absolute or 100%. He talks about, we talk about, say, you have absolute spirits, 100% vodka, or something like that. It's kind of like that kind of purity, that kind of essential kind of essence. So that's the kind of purity we're looking at. And it's very much associated with kind of, or how can we engage with a sense of that for ourselves? How can we engage in purifying ourselves? So he kind of, how can we purify ourselves? I suppose that's what Vajrasattva can really offer us, is a sense that in kind of being kind of in communication with Vajrasattva, he offers this sense of being able to really be with Vajrasattva, with all our faults, with all of our foolishness, with all of our deluded mind. So Vajrasattva, I keep talking about him like he's real, because to me he is. This kind of Vajrasattva, you know, in the presence of Vajrasattva, we have the opportunity to really kind of, I don't know, it feels like kind of bare our soul in a way, not hide anything, not hide the things that we might feel guilty about, ashamed of. on kind of lesser and grosser kind of scales. So Vajrasattva is very much associated with confession and being able to be totally honest. So for me, that would be a sense of being 100% kind of authentic and pure of Vajrasattva. And hopefully that would lead us to being more and more that way with Sangha, with our friends, because that part, I suppose, is not easy. And that's why I think for myself, I feel separate from Vajrasattva. What's in the way, what gets in the way of me and Vajrasattva, that separation between lower and higher, is a sense of, you know, what I feel in my inadequacy. And when I am not skillful, so my unskillfulness holds me at a distance from Vajrasattva. So coming on to some of the symbolism of Vajrasattva, he holds the Vajra and he holds the bell. So the Vajra, just going to go into the symbolism of the Vajra as holding the two poles of the poisons and the wisdoms. So the Vajra holds the poisons of hatred, akshobhya, the jinnas, really. So the poisons transformed into the wisdoms. So hatred into the mirror-like wisdom, pride into the wisdom of equality, excuse me, greed into the discriminating wisdom, envy into the all-accomplishing wisdom, and ignorance into the wisdom of the Dhammadhatu, the wisdom of reality. What I kind of love about this particular Vajra, in Vajrasattva, is that he holds it to his heart. So other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas hold a Vajra, like Shobhya holds his Vajra lower, Vajrapani holds his Vajra higher, but Vajrasattva holds the poisons and the wisdoms right there to his heart, which for me feels like a real aspiration, a real intention to want to transform, my unskillfulness into the wisdoms of the five jinnas. And he's got the jinnas on his crown, so, and he's an embodiment of all the jinnas. Diamond is created deep, 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 deep down in the earth after a long, 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 long time. Carbon that gets kind of compressed into coal, gets compressed by the pressure of the earth. I think it's created something like 75 miles under the earth, where the pressure of the earth changes the chemicals, the constitutions of something as rough, black, kind of what we probably associate as quite dirty, gritty kind of lump of carbon, into something as pure, shining, brilliant, immutable as diamond. So they might also be part of those two poles. And I don't know about you, but I've certainly experienced a lot of pressure and tension in my spiritual life. That tension between, you know, wanting, longing to be more Vajrasattva-like, more Buddha-like, and the reality of where I actually am. So having to accept that reality... help me, Vajrasattva. So that kind of gap, that separation, I think, you know, kind of really shows me kind of, and that kind of, I suppose it really ties into a longing faith, that longing to be kind of knowing that I can be more skillful, of knowing I can be more than what I am. And Vasantra says that holding the Vajra at the heart is holding, or kind of, make sure I get this right, is holding, or letting go of hopes, expectations, and fantasies. So letting go of hopes, expectations, and fantasies. And then what's left? But what I find in my practice of Vajrasattva is that those hopes, expectations, and fantasies I can offer up to Vajrasattva. So it's not that I'm left with nothing, it's that I can offer them to Vajrasattva. All my unskillfulness, all my longing, all my kind of dreams of whatever they might be, I can offer them up to Vajrasattva, and in that way I can let go of them and maybe come back down, come to kind of like see myself more as I am, flawed, foolish, full of petty kind of grievances, irritable, envious at times, you know, kind of, and I suppose the quality of not wanting to really see that, just wanting to see perhaps, you know, that I'm all right. So it's not that I want to see those things to beat myself up and give myself a hard time, but I want to start to see those things more and more clearly so I can transform them. So I can transform them so that I can kind of open up to the qualities of Vajrasattva, kind of the openness, clarity, sensitivity of Vajrasattva. So I kind of really like to hold the Vajra to the heart. The Vajrasattva seed syllable is the Hung. So you can't see it in this picture. So in his heart is the deep blue seed syllable, Hung, which Lama Govinda says is where the individual and the universal meet. So all my individual foolishness, insecurities, hopes, fears, fantasies, expectations can be met kind of in that Hung, with a kind of like the sense that, well, we all have those hopes, longings, fears. But also the universal sense of the bigger picture, which is the teaching of the Dhamma, and reality as essentially pure, my nature as essentially pure, and everybody's nature as essentially pure outside time and space. So Vasantra also talks about the Vajra is what is. So when you let go of all those hopes, fears, expectations, we are left with just what is. Things just as they are, the seen as the seen, the heard as the heard. That's what we're left with. Just things as they are, without our own interpretations, without our own ego clinging, without our own sense of how things should be or how things should be for me. We're just left with what is, which is a place, I think, of freedom, ultimately. That's what we're kind of left with. So the Vajra is skillful means. The Vajra that Vajrasattva holds is gold. And it also represents when we can transform those poisons into wisdom. It's deep, deep compassion. So there's a sense of compassion. And then, in his left hand, Vajrasattva holds the bell. So the bell representing the wisdom element. It's a silver bell with a Vajra handle. So like these ones here, silver bell with a Vajra handle. So a bell, the sound of a bell often summons us. Reminds us in meditation, come back to whichever meditation we're doing. It kind of wakes us up and reminds us. And that's what Vajrasattva is doing with the bell, waking us up, reminding us of our essential nature. So it's the wisdom element of Vajrasattva. So he's holding the Vajra and the bell together. So it's the play of wisdom and compassion. The play of form and emptiness. That's Vajrasattva. And I particularly like this image as well because Vajrasattva for me is not static, not still. Vajrasattva is slightly dancing. Vajrasattva, you know, it's not quite like a very still, say, some of the other Bodhisattva figures. But Vajrasattva's kind of got this constant motion. Especially when you're doing the long mantra, there's like a little dance along. So there's this kind of, I don't know, deep engagement somehow, a deep engagement with kind of the, I suppose, the sense of deep meditation, deep kind of awareness, and just a little bit of a playful aspect, this playful sense of form and emptiness, of things arising within this space and then ceasing, rising and ceasing, the constant kind of play of our mind. But the more we can kind of recognize that it's just play, it's just arising, it's just ceasing, and we can see kind of into the nature of Vajrasattva, behind that is open awareness, this kind of, and this purity. The more we can just let things arise and fall away and arise and fall away without putting our stories on top of them. So for me, there's a sense there of a real coming home. I think Vajrasattva is really calling us to come home to how things really are, to what reality is, and to what we are, in a way that I find really compassionate, that it's okay we're flawed, it's okay we're a bit lost, it's okay we don't really quite know where we're going. It's okay that... sometimes we are unskillful. As long as we're wanting to kind of see that and transform it, we can't do that unless we allow ourselves to really see that. So Vajrasattva is kind of calling us home to the reality of our situation, the reality of ourselves. That kind of in that sense of kind of like searching, perhaps we'll get used to, through our practice, dipping in and out, dipping in and out, making samsara work for us, perhaps, oh no, not again, back to kind of putting ourselves more wholeheartedly into practice, that we will kind of start to discover our own spiritual riches, and we will become more and more familiar with those spiritual riches, and we'll start to embody those spiritual riches. I love the fact that in ordination, our name is qualities. It's just qualities that we can become. Qualities maybe that we possess some of already, but qualities that we can become. It's got nothing to do with a sense of self or an ego. It's these qualities that the Vajrasattva is kind of drawing us on to. And he has... a very beautiful mantra, the 100-syllable mantra, in which we're kind of invited to come closer and closer to Vajrasattva. We kind of implore Vajrasattva to come closer to us through this bond, to stand before us, to stand beside us, and to love us deeply, to love us passionately. It's beautiful poetry. We'll read it in a bit, but a beautiful, beautiful kind of sense of this longing for Vajrasattva to be close. And I think my experience of doing the Vajrasattva sadhana, which I took at ordination in 2006, is that if we ask Vajrasattva, he will come and stand close by us. He will be there. We're not separate from that nature. And whenever we can remember that, we experience Vajrasattva. We experience Vajrasattva qualities of purity, the diamond, skillful means and compassion united, and a sense of play, form and emptiness arising and falling. And then we can rest. So Vajrasattva really invites us just to rest in the nature of reality. I think one of once when I was early on, when I was doing the sadhana, Vajrasattva was just saying, just rest, just rest. There's nothing to do. There's nowhere to go. Just rest. And I found myself just floating on a lake of pure white nectar. Just nothing, totally held. Nothing to do, but just be open and receptive to Vajrasattva. So just resting in the nature of awareness, nature of reality.